Three was absence of a historical prologue. Four is absence of a basic stipulation. Remember in the Hittite form, under the stipulation you got basic detail. Basic is that fundamental obligation of loyalty. It comes immediately after the prologue. I've done this for you. You are to love, to serve, be obedient, so forth. Hittite treaties don't have that. So that's a second structural difference. Excuse me, the Assyrian treaties don't have it, you see. The declaration of allegiance to the head partner by the vassal. Allegiance to the head partner by the vassal flows from the historical prologue in the Hittite treaties. Now, of course, you don't have a historical prologue in the Assyrian treaties, and of course, then it follows you also don't have that basic stipulation. So, instead of that, the Assyrian treaties have this oath of allegiance. But you notice that's in quite a different context. Look what it's enclosed in. Follows curses. And it's followed by more curses. So the oath is taken in a context of fear rather than one of trust. See, in the Hittite treaties, you have the historical prologue followed by that basic stipulation, which is, I've done this for you, now on the basis of what I've done for you, you serve me, be loyal to me. So again, it emphasizes the difference in the relationship, the quality of the relationship between the two partners. All right, that's four, absence of a basic stipulation. Five is absence of blessings. There's another structural difference in keeping with the harsh tone of the Assyrian treaties. There are no blessings enumerated for keeping the treaty stipulation. Hittite treaties have curses and blessings. Assyrian treaties have only curses. No blessings. Blessing is one of the permanent features of the Hittite treaties. So I think we could say that its absence, again, is an important difference when you compare the two groups of treaties. Not only from a standpoint of structure, but also from a standpoint of the relationship that's being established. Yes?
In the back of the those curses, even though the back was in state and cursing,
yes.
But it doesn't mean, you know, that they were imperatives.
Well,
those curses.
Yeah, probably. You get a hint of it then. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. The Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. But otherwise, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So are those absences in Assyrian treaties maybe assumed or may have been
Well, you could argue that, maybe. You see, as far as curses and blessings, if you look at Exodus, Exodus 20, of course, is only one section of it. But the Decalogue, you know, the Ten Commandments. You get a hint of blessing in the commandment concerning honoring the parents. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land. that would correspond to, if you do that, you'll be blessed. But it's not developed, it's not worked out, and it's not with every one of them, admittedly. But I think the element of curse and blessing is there in the Ten Commandments. Certainly it's much clearer in Deuteronomy.
Right. So my question is, those specific curses are not mentioned in this chapter. But it doesn't mean they're, not curses.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, so, all right. All right. You find it spelled out in more detail in Deuteronomy. Which means you're saying it's implied in the Exodus even though it isn't there. That's possible. Yeah.
I think the other part of his question was that if it can be implied that a curse is there, could it not also be implied that a blessing there as well and that it's not?
You probably could say that. But that's in the context of this structure. In the context of this structure, there's just no hint of it. You know, with the Assyrian thing of the gods, the stipulation, curses. There's no hint of it at all.
I want to see where the implication of the curse, whether it's explicitly in the text or not, of any treaty, because king is laying down law. If you do not follow his law, it's understood. People have to pay the consequences. However, blessings are a completely gracious act of the king. The king is not obligated to bless the masses.
Difference. All right, that was number 5. 6 is stipulations of the Assyrian treaties are one-sided. The stipulations of the Assyrian treaties are aimed solely toward the minor partner. In other words, the obligations are obligations of the minor partner toward the great king. There's no hint of reciprocal responsibility. That's something that's common in the Hittite treaties. In other words, in the Hittite treaties, it's not only that the great king is saying, look, I want you to do this and this for me. He also obligates himself to do certain things for the vassal. So there's a reciprocal relationship there. That's absent in the one-sided nature of the Assyrian stipulations. 7, the Assyrian treaties are strictly succession treaties. The subject matter of the Assyrian treaties is quite different from that of the Hittite. In the Assyrian treaty, the whole thing is directed to one particular issue, and that is the issue of succession. The succession of Ashurbanipal to Esarhaddon. So, when you compare that with the Hittite treaties are not confined to merely one aspect of the relationship between the partners, but they cover a wide range of topics of importance to both sides of the agreement. So, 8 is conclusion. It seems to me that we can say, on the basis of these considerations, that there are important differences between the treaties of Esarhaddon and those of the Hittites. The structural pattern is different in the Assyrian treaties, and closely connected with that is a different spirit, so that the relationship, instead of being one of mutual support, is one of harsh demands and threats by the Assyrian king placed on the vassal. Now, on the basis of those kinds of considerations, it seems to me that Meredith Klein does have a reasonable basis for saying that the Assyrian treaties are different from the earlier Hittite treaties, and that there's an evolution or change in the form of the treaty document over that period of time. It seems to me that there's There's adequate reason for him to conclude that. Now, interestingly enough, Mendenhall, who wrote that article in 54 that called the attention to the analogy between the treaty material and the covenant material, Mendenhall, Albright, and John Bright, among others, are in agreement with Klein on that. Mendenhall, in his original article, Law and Covenant, says, quote, "This covenant type is even more important as a starting point for the study of Israelite traditions because of the fact that it cannot be proven to have survived the downfall of the great empires of the late 2nd millennium B.C. When empires arose again, notably Assyria, the structure of the covenant by which they bound their vassals is entirely different." Now, that was Mendenhall's state. See, that you can't prove that the original Hittite treaty structure survived. When you come down to the next millennium, the Assyrian treaties, it's an entirely different structure, he says. He says, further, in all the materials we have, the historical prologue is missing. That is all the Assyrian ones. And only the Assyrian deities are listed as witnesses. The entire pattern is also radically different. It is, of course, possible that the form survived elsewhere, but the writer has been able to find no evidence for it. We should also expect that even if it did survive, more or less far-reaching changes in form would also have taken place. End of quote. Albright, in Stone Age to Christianity, agrees with Mendenhall and says the structure of half a dozen Assyrian, Aramean, and Phoenician treaties, which we know from the 8th century B.C. and later, is quite different. And similar with John Bright in his history of Israel. So it puzzles me why, given those considerations, why Wiseman, as well as McCarthy, say that the form is essentially the same. Because both Wiseman, who published the Assyrian treaties, and McCarthy argue that the form is essentially the same. Wiseman says in that publication of the treaties, in his comments on it, he says, the form of the treaties was already standardized by the Hittite Empire, and this text, that is the Vassal Treaty of Esarhaddon, shows that it remained basically unchanged through Neo-Assyrian times. He speaks of the standardized Hittite form, and he says it's unchanged through the Assyrian times. And then McCarthy picks that up, supports Wiseman, and says, quote, "It is said that the Assyrian and other treaties of the first millennium are entirely different in structure from the Hittite form of the second millennium. It seems to me that the analysis just completed fails to bear this out." And then more recently still, Moshe Weinfeld, in his book Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomic School, 1972, says, there is no justification for regarding the formulation of the Hittite treaties as being unique. Nor is there any basis for Mendenhall's supposition that only Hittite treaties served as the model and archetype of the biblical covenant. Now, you can draw your own conclusion, but you see, what you have is Wiseman, McCarthy, and Weinfeld saying, there's basically no difference between the Assyrian treaties and Hittite treaties. Whereas you have Klein, Bright, Albright, Mendenhall, and others saying there is a radical change between the Hittite form and the Assyrian form. Now, radical change, there are certain elements that are similar. I mean, you have stipulations, you have curses, you have witnesses. True, you have some similarities. But in the midst of those similarities, my point, and I think that Mendenhall's point and others, is there's some striking differences that are of enough significance that you can't say they're in the modification of the form. Question?
Sorry, has anybody looked behind these treaty forms to see why there are differences? Are there different worldviews between the Hittites and the Assyrians that are really affecting this?
I don't know. I've never seen any discussion of that. You know, the Assyrians are known, I mean, this kind of this kind of treaty fits with what's known of Assyrian military techniques and strategies, which were, they were, you know, just a very violent, ruthless military power who forced themselves on other people and ruled by terror. And this kind of thing fits with that.
Whereas what we see of the Hittites sounds like they have more of a view of the
Sounds like. Now, I don't know historically if there's enough known about Hittite Empire where, you know, materials from it are not, there's not very much left of it. In fact, you know, it's completely lost empire until comparatively recent times when the capital was discovered and certain documents were found and so forth. But there's not a lot of historic material there. Another question?
Way back in three or four, you said that there's a debate on whether historical prologue for each of the treaties. I was wondering if that also applied for 4 and 5.
I don't know. It's not. I've never seen any much discussion there as far as debate. It's mainly with that historical prologue. Yeah. Yes.
Considering the last chapters of Deuteronomy, where Moses, after giving the curses, he almost seems to.
That's similar. That's interesting.
Yeah. And in doing that, as another question I've got is that if Wiseman and McCarthy, if liberal thinking, not that they are, but liberal thinking, with, let's say Ben Rod, turn around and say that this was an adaptation by the Israelites in the 7th century?
I'll come to that. I guess under C, implication of treaty covenant analogy for David Deuteronomy. Wiseman, I haven't seen discuss that issue. Wiseman's evangelical. I'm not sure what he does with that, but because I've never seen anything where he's really addressed it. But what Weinfeld does, and several others, and McCarthy, is argue that there is the treaty covenant analogy, and the form is found in the biblical materials, but it was taken from the Assyrians at a late date, date 600-700, and get around the historical implications of Mosaic origin in that way. Now, you see, if there's the evolution in treaty form, to say that the Israelites got it from the Assyrians doesn't fit the form. That's why, you see, that's why this point is of such significance to Klein's argument. But I'll come back to that. Let's go on to B, the Aramaic treaties from Safiri, compared with the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon and with the Hittite suzerainty treaties. First introductory remarks. There were Aramaic treaties called treaties, the Safiri treaties. They date from the 8th century B.C. In other words, they're a little bit earlier than the Hittite treaties. Hittite treaties 672. Excuse me. Syrian treaties 672. Safiri treaties 8th century. 700s. They are generally referred to simply as Safiri 1, 2, and 3. There are three texts. Safiri Roman 1, Roman 2, Roman 3. And they were found at the place called Safiri in northern Syria about 60 years ago. But it wasn't until 1958, that they were published and have received some study. Two of them are in the Damascus Museum, and a third one is in a museum in Beirut today. All right, two, brief survey of the form. I've put an outline of the form there. You notice there are now nine parts. Title, Gods Who Are Witnesses, Curses with Accompanying Rights, The Sacred Character of the Treaty, The Stipulations, 7, Reminder for the Future, 8, Blessings, 9, Curses. Now that form is taken from the first text, Sapiri Roman 1, which is a complete text. The others are quite fragmentary. But you have a title that introduces the contracting parties. It says the Treaty of Bir Gaya, king of a certain place, with Matiel, the son of Atarsamach, the king of Arpad, and so on. So you have the two partners to the treaty introduced. Now it's the Treaty of Bir Gaya, B-I-R-G-A-Y-A-H. That individual is not known apart from this reference to him. There's no other reference known. The land of which he was king is also not been identified with certainty. The vassal, Matiel, is identified in another treaty of the Assyrians, a treaty of Ashur-nirari, the 5th of Assyria. So he's a ruler in northern Syria between the Euphrates and the Mediterranean, about 754 BC. I won't go down through all these sections. I think from the headings you can see what the type of material is. In the curses with accompanying rites, you have a section like this. Just as this wax is burned by fire, shall Arpad be burned and her daughter cities. So it sounds like they were, just as this wax is burned, they were demonstrating again the curse. The second Sapiri treaty text is very fragmentary. It was found in about a dozen pieces. When the pieces were fitted together, you have portions of an inscription that seems very similar to this structure. But it's not of great value for comparison with other treaties. Question there? That's very similar to the Assyrian. Mm-hmm. The third document is again fragmentary, and it only has stipulations. That's the only section that's left on the third document, is at number 6. But it's the most extensive collection of stipulations on any of the three texts. So you get a fairly large body of stipulations. They concern things like the surrender of plotters, the surrender of fugitives, freedom of passage, crossing of borders, vengeance to be taken in case of assassination, reciprocal return of fugitives, various things of that sort. The stipulations, as far as they are preserved, are one-sided. They regulate the conduct of the vassal, but are not of a reciprocal nature, with one exception, and that is that return of fugitives. So there's one exception to that. Generally, though, they're one-sided. All right, let's go on to three. Similarities of the Seferi treaties to the Assyrian treaties. If you look at that structure, you find a similarity in the absence of a historical prologue. The Assyrian treaties had no historical prologue. The Seferi treaties have no historical prologue. So in that sense, you can say the Seferi treaties are closer to the Assyrian treaties than they are to the Hittite treaties. No historical prologue.
What is that?
That's the basic stipulation. Grundsatz Erklärung. That's it.
What about Assyrian and
they don't have that either. That's true. They don't have the historical prologue or the basic stipulation, either one. Don't have the historical prologue or the basic stipulation. Grundsatz, they're clear. Fitzmyer says one element in particular is significantly absent, the historical prologue. Whatever reason may be assigned for the omission of this element in the Aramaic treaties, the absence of it constitutes a major difference between the Aramaic and Hittite treaties. This element is basic to the Hittite conception of the covenant. It constitutes the legal framework of the Hittite suzerainty treaty. Hittite suzerains recalled their favors toward the vassals as well as those of their predecessors in order to establish the obligation of the vassal's loyalty and service. Indeed, it is precisely this element which is absent from covenants of the first millennium B.C., whether they be Aramaic or Assyrian. This qualification seems to be necessary in view of the claim made by Wiseman that the covenant form remained basically unchanged through near Assyrian times. You see, you're back to that point of dispute. And the man there, Fitzmyer, I quoted from, is the man who published the Aramaic inscriptions of Seferi. That's this volume. You can read those texts in here and his comments on it. All right, secondly, not only is the historical prologue and that basic stipulation missing, but also the stipulations are one-sided. I already mentioned that, with the exception of that return of fugitives, one-sided. That, again, contrasts with the Hittite treaties. I mentioned that before in connection with the Assyrian treaties, which are also one-sided. You see, in the Hittite treaties, you often have what are called protection clauses, where the great king commits himself to protecting the vassal. Fensham, F.C. Fensham, says one of the most humane stipulations in the Hittite treaties is the promise of protection of the vassal against enemies. This protection might have been promised to safeguard the head partner's kingdom, but was still a most encouraging experience for the vassal. There was no enemy to fear. Under such conditions, small kingdoms could prosper and times of peaceful coexistence could develop. There's no protection clause in the Assyrian treaties or the Seferi treaties. And then another difference is the placement of the witness section. See, in these Seferi treaties, The gods are called upon as witnesses right after the introductory paragraph, the title, the preamble. You notice where the witnesses are in the Hittite treaty. That's after the stipulations rather than before. So, see, this follows more closely the Assyrian form than it does the I'll go with my Assyrian form here. The Assyrian form has gods as witnesses right after the preamble. There are certain similarities, even though there are those differences we've just looked at. There are certain things where the Aramaic treaties are closer to the Hittite treaties than they are to the Assyrian treaties. And you see that, first of all, in that gods of both partners are named as witnesses. And you have the gods who are listed as witnesses. The gods of both the great king and the vassal are cited in the Aramaic treaties. And in the Hittite treaties, the gods of both partners are witnesses, the great king as well as the vassal. But the Assyrian treaties name only the Assyrian deity. They don't name the deities of the minor part. So at that point, the Sumeri treaties are closer to the Hittite treaties. Secondly, the subject matter of the stipulations is broader than the Assyrian treaties. Assyrian treaties are concerned only with succession. The Sumeri treaties are much broader, and in that sense, they're a lot closer to the Hittite treaties. And then thirdly, Pitzmaier, in his discussion of the Sumeri treaties, points out that the style of formulation of some of the stipulations is very close to the Hittite treaty formulation of some of the stipulations. It's very close correspondence. So you could point that out as well. So that brings me five to conclusion. I think we can conclude that the treaties of Sumeri exhibit some affinities with the earlier Hittite treaties. But at the same time, there are important differences, particularly the absence of the historical prologue and that basic stipulation and the one-sided nature of the stipulation. So it seems like you get a progression. You've got the classic Hittite form, and then you get the Sumeri treaties and then the Esarhaddon treaties. And it seems to align like this. The Sumeri has more relations to the Hittite than this does, but it's also got some there. It's sort of halfway between, you might say, the Sumeri treaties and structure and characteristics. Some likenesses to the Assyrian treaties, some to the Hittite treaties. But it does seem like, you see, what Klein says, there's an evolution of the development of the treaty form. Which brings me then to see. Yeah.
Is there a basic difference then in that the Hittite treaties seem to be more of a mutual agreement, where these others seem, if you're saying one side, there's no real agreement there other than it's more of a mandatory obligation?
Yeah, well, I think you could probably argue, even with the Hittite, he was a great king. He was imposing himself on the vassal. I don't know if the vassal had a lot of choice, but it was done in a quite different manner. And there were certain benefits to it. Whereas here, and it's a relationship of trust, whereas here it's one of fear. So
trust is
I think that's more important. Yeah.
The responsibility and faithfulness of the vassal.
It's more.
Or not. Oh, yeah. And I mean the faithfulness of the sovereign.
Yeah.
But the vassal still had to exhibit faithfulness. I mean, and responsibility.
He had to do that, but there was reason for him to want to respond out of gratitude, because in the historical prologue, usually in the Hittite treaties, the great king says, "I've done this for you, I've done that for you, I've done the other thing for you." So there was reason for the vassal to respond. probably didn't have a lot of choice, but nevertheless, it's quite a different situation than what you find in the Assyrian treaties. Yeah.
With the views that maybe the Hittite treaty wasn't quite as uniform as Brian would like to say it is.
Yeah.
I don't understand how then they could argue drawing the relationship between the covenant form of Deuteronomy in these treaties. It seems to be so close to the form that Brian is outlining. If they don't have that form, it doesn't correspond to a later treaty as well. So how can they
well,
play to the later date?
I'm coming to that. See, what they want to do is minimize the difference and say it's basically one form all the way through,
and then say well, Deuteronomy comes down here instead of up here.
But Deuteronomy then is totally different from all of them.
Well,
it shows a lot of difference.
Yeah, I would think so. I think it's the weakness of their argument. But that's where a lot of these people are trying to get around, it seems to me, the force of Klein's model. So there's really not much difference between these treaties and that.
But in doing so, they break the whole model down, though, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, they'd say they don't.
Yeah.
But it seems to me if you look at them and look at that structure, Klein is justified in concluding that there is a real difference between the classic form and the later form. Yeah.
What is the place of Moses, all your academic background, and the Bible Trust, and if he was advocating in all the wisdom of the Egyptians?
We don't know, but he grew up in the court of the pharaohs. We know that the pharaohs, of course, your dating here is somewhat of a question. When was the Exodus? But we know that the pharaohs had relations with the Hittite Empire. And there was a treaty concluded between Ramses II, around 1290, with Hattusilis of the Hittite Empire. And we have a copy of that treaty. It's not a suzerain-vassal treaty. It's a parity treaty, so the two were pretty much equals. But there was contact between the Hittites and the Egyptians. So if Moses was in Egypt in the time of Ramses, that's a debatable thing. He may have been a little bit earlier than that. But it's reasonable to assume that he may have had knowledge of these kinds of documents, I think.
What I'm curious is, McCarthy claimed there are several that person have historical prologue given Hittite treaty.
Yeah.
So in that case, even though we can hardly say that the history is not an essential for their treaty form, but their, more plausibly, there should be a function of Moses. Academic background in Egypt. And culturally and politically and historically, Egypt much more superior to those Assyria or Hittite or any other Semitic country.
Mm. Well, yeah, I think you're right on that. I mean, it certainly gives a plausible explanation as to how it came that God utilized Moses in giving this material to the Israelites in this particular form. Now what somebody like Weinfeld, Moshe Weinfeld, argues is that the court scribes in the time of, say, Hezekiah were familiar with the Assyrian treaty form, and they came through that mechanism. I'll come back to that. Let's go to C. The implications of the treaty covenant analogy for the date of Deuteronomy. It seems to me that the evidence justifies the conclusion that the Hittite treaties can be said to represent a unique early form of the treaty, which is not duplicated in later treaties, either those of Esarhaddon or Sapphira. And closely connected with that is the different spirit reflected in the Hittite treaties. Rooted in the gratitude and respect of the vassal for the suzerain. The Syrian treaties are a different structure, entirely different spirit. The Safiri treaties, some similarities to the Hittite treaties, more so than the Assyrian ones do, but they also lack that important historical prologue and basic stipulation. So that I think Klein speaks with good reason of the evolution of the documentary form of suzerainty treaties. He admits the differences shouldn't be exaggerated, that it's indeed one species that you meet through Old Testament time, one species. But he does find a discernible evolution. And then he says Deuteronomy corresponds more closely in structure and spirit to the earlier Hittite treaties than to either the Safiri treaties or the Assyrian treaties of the 8th and 7th centuries. And I think Klein's conclusion has a great deal of merit and deserves attention, and more so than it's received, particularly by some of these critical scholars. Klein concludes on page 43 of his Treaty of the Great King, while it is necessary to recognize a substantial continuity and pattern between the earlier and later treaties, it is proper to distinguish the Hittite treaties of the second millennium BC as the classic form. And without any doubt, the book of Deuteronomy belongs to the classic stage in this documentary evolution. Here, then, is significant confirmation of the prima facie case for the Mosaic origin of Deuteronomy Treaty of the Great King. Well, that's the essence of his thesis, and I think he's warranted in drawing that conclusion. Now, to go a bit beyond that, you're reading J.A. Thompson in his Tyndale Old Testament Commentary, volume on Deuteronomy. He says on pages 51 and 52 that he has reservations about the strength of Klein's argument. And as you read Thompson, you'll find he argues for a date for Deuteronomy in the 11th to 10th centuries BC, the period of the United Monarchy of David and Solomon. Roughly that time. So it's post-Mosaic, but early in the period of the kingdom, the United Monarchy, time of David and Solomon. He sees Moses behind the heart of the book, but he thinks editorial processes have brought it to the present form, and that that happened subsequent to the time of Moses. In other words, he doesn't accept Klein's thesis that this form supports a Mosaic date for origin of the material. And he suggests this with respect to Klein's thesis. He suggests Deuteronomy was put in the shape of the treaty form by someone writing long after Moses' day. Suggests that Deuteronomy could have been put in the shape of the treaty form by someone writing long after Moses' day. In other words, he doesn't deny the treaty covenant analogy, but says it could have been adopted later on, the form. His view there is very similar to the view of a man named Frankina, F-R-A-N-K-E-N-A. That's only a 50 adjective. Page 4 under Deuteronomy treaty form. R. Frankina, the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon and the dating of Deuteronomy. Frankina looks at the Assyrian treaties and argues for Hebrew dependence on the Assyrian treaties in particularly the curse formulations of Deuteronomy. He says they're closely related to the formulations of the Assyrian treaties. So So he's laying them down this time. And also, as I already mentioned, Moshe Weinfeld speaks of court scribes in the time of Hezekiah and Josiah being familiar with the Assyrian treaty form and bringing it into Israel. And so through that mechanism, it's come to be used with Deuteronomy. So that Thompson comments, the possibility must be allowed that Deuteronomy was cast in the shape of an ancient treaty by someone who wrote long after Moses' day. Possibility must be allowed that Deuteronomy was cast in the shape of an ancient treaty by someone who wrote long after Moses' day. So that's one thing he says. Another thing he says is the historical prologue argument is not sound because the Assyrian and Aramaic treaties may either have assumed a prologue or it may have been stated orally. He doesn't deny that it's absent, but he says they may have assumed it or stated it orally, and therefore it's not in the text. And therefore you can't make much of the fact that it doesn't have a historical prologue. And in addition, he claims evidence of a 7th century treaty text with a historical prologue. That is one down roughly in this period of time that has a historical prologue. The problem is that's a disputed text and a very fragmented and broken text, and we look at people who have examined it and there's dispute about whether there is one or isn't one. But in any case, Thompson attempts to weaken the case for the evolution of the treaty form by suggesting the historical prologue is not a unique feature of the early Hittite treaty. So he concludes, hence the fact that Deuteronomy has a historical introduction is not necessarily an argument for a date in the second millennium. Although it may be. He hedges there. Not necessarily, but it may be. I see my time's about up. I guess I can't go very far. I want to interact a bit with Thompson, not only in those two arguments, that is the historical prologue argument and the idea of was put in the treaty form by someone writing later. I'll comment on that. And then a couple other arguments he has. But we'll have to do that next week, I guess, the beginning of our session next week, before we go on to the centralization thing. I think it's important to interact a bit with Thompson, because Thompson's commentary is in the InterVarsity series, which is generally an evangelical series, and you might expect that Thompson would support Mosaic date and buy into Klein's argument, but he doesn't. Okay.